This is Teddy Roosevelt, just back from charging up San Juan Hill. Damn it, Professor Buzzkill was already at the top, collecting historical evidence, busting myths, and taking names. I have to admit that he's a worthy competitor, and a damn fine rough rider. Join me in listening to this episode. It's sure to be bully.
Yes, Buzzkillers, it's April here in the United States of America, and for almost all of us, that means it worries about taxes and taxation. And of course, Americans are famously angry about taxes and have been for a long time. But fortunately, I'm not angry because Professor Nash from the Pennsylvania State University is here to tell us about the history of taxation in the U.S., what it's all about, and whether it's supposed to help with inequality and things like that in our country. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing great.
Are you heavily taxed?
I'm heavily taxed, but I'm also here with my famous calming influence, so hopefully.
Oh, right. Yes, yes. You are the calming. Yeah, yeah. You're the reason people don't, you know, charge the barricades.
Yes. No, my students view me as a sedative, so.
Do they? Okay. But your students, like everyone else in the United States, and again, apologies to foreign outside buzzkillers. We're going to talk about American taxation, and we know that taxes usually aren't as crazy in other parts of the world as they are here. But do your students and do people in general talk about taxes going way back to the revolution, as that's the reason for the revolution?
Sure, understanding, and they're not entirely wrong. Taxes were certainly one of the big issues that helped lead to our revolution. Mm-hmm. The British Empire famously or infamously jacked taxes in the 13 colonies massively to help pay for the French and Indian War Imperial defense. And if you think about things like the Stamp Act, those taxes were definitely a major cause of the revolution. I'd like to quickly bust a mini myth.
Oh?
The Tea Act, which led to the famous Boston Tea Party. Which, just while on the subject, they dumped in today's money an estimated $800,000 worth of tea into Boston Harbor.
That's a lot of tea.
Yeah, and that's why the British were really, really angry wanted that money back.
It wasn't symbolic at all.
They jacked up a lot of tea.
Well, there you go.
In any case, they did not dump the tea because the tea tax had gone up. The tax on the East India Company tea had actually gone down. It's really complicated. Won't get into it, but basically, patriots were incensed by what they viewed as an effort to bribe them with a lower tea tax.
Oh, okay.
No, they were not incensed because their tea became undrinkably expensive.
But this says to me, though, that the patriots, the colonists, are they're doing their reading. They're up and up on current issues. That this complicated thing is, it's not just some sort of knee-jerk reaction.
They were very tax aware. No question. Okay. Absolutely right.
Tax aware. That's another one to file away for the Buzzkill slang.
There you go.
Well, so that's the Tea Act. That's 1773,
correct?
And then the Boston Tea Party, and then things steamroll, so to speak, into the Revolution. But what happens after? Presumably, the American government doesn't exist, so the American government's not taxing anybody.
Right.
What happens
and then it is right.
And after the Revolution, when it sets itself up,
sure. So in the early Republic, this first period of U.S. history, as we call it, the government is small, as people might guess. Mm-hmm. And revenues for the government typically came from the tariff and from customs.
Yeah.
You didn't have an income tax.
Okay.
In fact, the income tax we're going to focus this whole show on is a very relatively late development in U.S. history.
Sure. And again, tariffs are taxes on imported duty.
Exactly
goods.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Or Alexander Hamilton, the now famous Alexander Hamilton, who was our first Secretary of the Treasury, he was big on excise taxes.
Right. We're not breaking out into song buzzkillers.
No, we are not going to do that.
I mean, we can if you want, but email us.
Song in quotation marks. Yeah. He pushes for excise taxes, most famously or infamously, especially here in Western PA, is the whiskey tax.
Okay, yeah.
And in the 1790s, whiskey, corn whiskey in particular, was a huge source of income and also barter for Western PA farmers.
Okay. In other words, PA, of course, meaning Pennsylvania. Remember, we have.
Sorry.
We are available in 134 countries. We need to make sure.
And all 50 states.
Yeah.
So,
but we don't want to give our location away too.
Sorry.
Pinpoint, because then, of course, they'll re-aim their missiles.
Absolutely. So, corn farmers, actually, it was a practical issue. Corn is much more movable in liquid form.
Oh.
So,
really?
Yeah. It was, it wasn't just about necessarily selling whiskey. It's about selling basically the value of corn in a concentrated form, if that makes any sense. Anyway.
In the 20th century, this will come up as the great corn syrup crisis.
Exactly, right. Controversy. Because of low fructose corn syrup. So this led to the Whiskey Rebellion because by jacking the excise tax on whiskey, the demand for corn whiskey went way down and a lot of these farmers suffered. And so they literally went on the warpath and had to be crushed by U.S. troops.
Yeah. Now, this is U.S. troops under Washington, right?
In fact, literally under Washington. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure.
George Washington, that is.
Yes. I'm pretty sure the only time in U.S. history when the commander-in-chief served as commander-in-chief.
In other words, both president and general,
who's leading troops in the field. That does not happen every day. In fact, it never happens.
Yeah.
So then we go to the 19th century where you still have no income and also, by the way, no corporate tax. You do not have these things.
Okay. So because tariffs can handle it all?
That was the belief. And tariffs, when it comes to taxation, tariffs were the big issue.
Yeah.
Those in the decades leading to the Civil War. There was an income tax proposed for the War of 1812, but the War of 1812 ended before they could be enacted.
That's right. Canadians burned the Capitol down, and therefore you don't need...
That's right. That's when the new White House was put to the torch. Only the extraordinary cost of the Civil War led to the first income tax.
Okay, Civil War. So now we're talking 1860.
1860s, correct.
This is a big jump in
chronology. We go a long time without having an income tax.
Uh-huh.
So the Union effort in the Civil War was financed through a lot of different... implementations. One is just high tariffs, also high alcohol and tobacco duties, a direct tax on business, and a tax on large inheritances, and also a tax on incomes of the wealthy. Now, all of those things I just listed paid for about 20% of the cost of the Civil War.
Holy cow. Only 20%?
Bonds, so war bonds in effect,
yeah.
And also printing paper money.
Yeah.
Just cranking them out. That covered the rest.
Ew.
So yeah, you had an income tax, but in terms of like paying for the war or sort of, shouldering the significant part of the burden of the war, income taxes didn't do very much.
But that seems to me they're printing a lot of paper money.
Yes, they are.
Things could go south
absolutely,
very quickly.
Indeed.
This could go south in the Civil War.
So tax historians look at this as saying that basically during the Civil War, we had the first quote-unquote modern fiscal system we ever had.
Okay.
In terms of the way that the things you tax and how you tax them and how you raise revenue, it's much more, in other words, it's much more like how taxes are collected today than they were before the Civil War.
Okay.
And so they'd use the word modern. But once again, this income tax was temporary.
Okay.
It was only during the war.
How do we then get to a permanent income tax?
Well,
are there even more stages?
Yeah, there are more stages. The first peacetime income tax was passed by Congress in 1894, and here we're getting into the so-called populist.
Another jump in 30 years.
Exactly. It takes a while. But by this time, we're in the so-called populist period, where we have the sort of grassroots backlash against late industrial capitalism.
Right.
And you have more and more of an interest in sort of making the rich and the corporations pay their fair share, that kind of rhetoric that you still hear today.
And it's all the more visible at this time because it's sort of what we call the Gilded Age.
Correct. Yes.
Seemed to be very, very rich.
Yes, when you had some super rich. With
Rockefeller and Carnegie.
Yes, and leading, some of them leading these very ostentatious lifestyles, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, which I'm used to, but other buzzkillers may
not be. That's why this bunker is so well appointed.
That's right.
So this was, however, effectively shot down by the Supreme Court in 1895. And so who cares? Well, this then means we have to have a constitutional amendment for federal income tax to go ahead. And that's why we have the 16th Amendment, which is finally ratified in 1913.
Does that sort of mean that the United States has only had federal income tax for 105 years?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
With the exception of the Civil War. Yeah, you have no peacetime federal income tax before 1913. And this was, at the time, this is in the heart of the progressive era. This is a major progressive reform. And keep in mind also, this is where we not only get taxation, income taxation, but we get progressive income taxation.
Okay, now let's remind the buzzkillers what that is.
Right. So you have a regressive tax, which means everyone's taxed at the same rate.
Okay.
Like, for example, a cigarette tax.
Yeah.
Rich people pay the same for cigarettes as poor people do. And what that means is because their incomes aren't equal, that disproportionately hurts poor people.
Right.
That's what a regressive. So a flat tax, any flat tax is regressive.
And therefore any sales tax, modern day sales tax.
Correct. Okay. Correct. And so this, however, income tax was from the get-go, this was envisioned as progressive. which is to say the more you make, the higher the rate you pay.
Okay, so it's like because there's a tax on income rather than a tax on what you spend for.
Right, right, exactly.
Again, cigarettes, yeah.
Right. And so, and one of the reasons this was so popular at the time is because it only really affected the very, very wealthy. Mm-hmm. But it was progressive via this mechanism called marginal tax rates. And it's really, really crucial and crucial that people understand what that means.
And this has come up in contemporary politics, that is 2018, 2019 politics, because a number of young Democrats have been talking about increasing marginal rates. Mm-hmm. And the reaction has been, oh my God, they're going to take
away
70%
of my income, which is a misnomer. I mean, it's politically useful for someone to make that claim, but it is really ignorant. Marginal tax rates means that you have a different tax rate for each tax bracket.
Okay.
So what the government does is they divide your income into layers or brackets.
Even one person's income.
One person's income, okay. Right. So, and obviously then how many layers you have depends on how much income you make.
Right.
And so, and those brackets will change in size, and the rates for each bracket will also change over time.
Okay.
And the number of brackets will change over time a lot.
Yeah.
As we'll see.
So there are a lot of buzzkill brackets for my parents, for instance, because they're rolling.
Because they're the Duke and Duchess.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Correct. Well, what that means is, so let's
say I never thought of individual taxpayers having their own brackets. I thought you were in a bracket.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I misspoke. You are in a bracket. But what I meant is that people's incomes differ.
Yes.
And so therefore, the number of brackets that matter for you will be different from person to person because your income is different.
Gotcha.
But basically, let's say you have brackets that are $10,000 each, just arbitrarily.
Yeah.
That means for everyone, the first $10,000 they make is taxed at a certain rate.
Yeah. Doesn't matter who you are.
Doesn't matter. Rich or poor, you're all taxed for that $10,000 at the same rate. And then you go up a layer to the next $10,000, and that might be taxed at a different rate.
Okay. So your money between $11,000 and $20,000
would then be taxed at a different rate.
Higher.
And so on, all the way up the different layers.
Okay.
And so that's why it's untrue. If the top rate is 90% or 70% or 50%, a person who makes enough money to make that top marginal rate, they don't have 50% of their income taken away.
It's only 50% of the top
income above that top margin. Correct.
And that margin is quite high. The top margin is very high.
Right. And so if you look at the first, I mean, people might laugh at this now, but the 1914 tax law, the first federal income tax law, was a tax of between 1 and 7%. Which is hilarious today because today our lowest bracket is something like 10%.
Yeah,
I think it's 10%. So between 1 and 7% on incomes of $4,000 or more,
How much would that be today?
That's about $100,000 today.
Okay.
So anyone making less than $100,000 today would not be taxed at all at the federal level.
Oh, okay. Well,
So now this was coupled with tariff reduction. Remember, tariffs are regressive, right? Tariffs affect everyone the same way. It's like a cigarette tax.
Yeah.
So with these two measures.
Why are you so obsessed with cigarettes? Can we also say something other than a food tax?
How about booze?
Yeah. Okay. That's the way life is here in the bunker.
Or it's marijuana, where it's been legalized.
Ciggies and booze.
So, exactly. It's all about vice. So this package of new measures, i.e. the federal income tax and the tariff reduction, together, this made the tax structure, the tax system more progressive and thus very popular at the time.
Okay, right.
These were very, very popular. And so in 1916, I should add that the first modern estate tax was added.
Oh, okay.
Where you have a tax on inheritances above a certain level,
mm-hmm.
also very controversial today. This was partly to provide equal opportunity,
in other
words, to make sure that people have relatively equal opportunities. But it was also, speaking of the Duke and Duchess, this was to do something about the idea of a permanent aristocracy, which we wanted to avoid in this country.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the passing out of massive inheritances, that's one of the things you're going to get from that is an aristocracy. So that was the idea behind it anyway.
And we should remind buzzkillers that these things pass through the Congress and they pass through the end.
They were perfectly legal.
Yeah. So this is not, I mean, this isn't a bunch of wild wacko radicals forcing rich people, but this is the whole society agreeing that this is okay.
Yeah. We were not invaded by hostile Martian tax collectors. Who imposed their confiscatory ways on us. No, that's not true.
Confiscatory ways. God.
Sorry. So, in the rest of the 20th century, taxes were pretty progressive compared to today.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in World War One, and they tended to go up in our world wars, not surprisingly, because the need, the federal government's need for money went way up. The top marginal rate was jacked up to 77%. So from 7% to 77%, right? Just add a 7 to help pay for the war. And then it went back down to 25% in the 1920s.
Oh, okay.
And this is a period of, we had Republicans in the White House, a relatively conservative age. And so the top rate went back down to 25%, which is even lower than what it is today, by the way.
Sure.
Today's top marginal rate, I think, is 38, 39.6, something like that. It's around there.
Right.
So the top marginal rate was hiked again during the New Deal, up to 80%. And then during World War II, get this, top marginal rate of 94%.
94?
So if you make it into the very, very highest brackets, and by the way, you had about 30 brackets.
Wow.
Which is a lot. So it's hyper-graduated. But if you made it into the top bracket, the government took 94% of what you made at that bracket and above.
So these are people, hugely wealthy people that time, like wealthy. Joe Kennedy.
Right.
Right, is paying at the top margin of his income.
He's paying 94%.
Yeah.
Now, Franklin Roosevelt, interestingly, in spring of 1942, so when the war had just started for the United States, he advocated a 100% top rate.
Wow.
His basic attitude, and you can find his message to Congress on this issue. You can find it online. He basically argued that in wartime, we have to share sacrifice, and basically no one should be making more than $25,000 a year.
Yeah.
Which,
again,
in today's dollars is about $350,000. Mm-hmm. But he basically said, in this national emergency, in this crisis, no one should make more than $350,000, period.
Right.
Like
right.
Anything you make above that, we should take 100%. Mm-hmm. Now, Congress did not agree with him.
No. Although it might not be, you know, horribly unpopular public opinion wise, because a lot of rich people might say, yeah, the war needs to be won.
And a lot of non-rich people would say that too. And also, but from another standpoint, how big really is the gap between 94% and 100%?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We're not talking 20 points or 30 points, we're talking six.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, they came close with 94%. And by the way, the top rate stayed above 90% into the early 1960s.
Oh, okay.
So, well after World War II.
Oh, yeah.
After the time of the World War II emergency had gone away, the top marginal rate. Now, like I said, the number of brackets, the rate at each bracket. And by the way, the rates don't necessarily go up from bracket to bracket. They might go down and then back up. In other words, they're not uniformly escalating through the brackets.
Oh, all right. Okay.
And also, the brackets are not always of equal size.
Oh, Lord.
They might be $2,000. It might be $10,000. They might be $50,000. That also varies. So, you know, the comparisons when you're talking about these are all very, very complicated and very sort of fraught. So people should keep that in mind, too, that often it's very, very difficult to compare apples to apples when you're talking about marginal tax rates.
Okay, and it's so complicated. I'm not surprised that you use commodities like cigarettes and alcohol to talk about.
The one thing people can relate to in this talk.
I feel like a good stiff drink trying to figure out these numbers.
Well, especially because our math skills are so strong.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That's why we got our PhDs in history. So then what? How does this affect equality and inequality during this same period?
Which, to my mind, I mean, you could take a tax discussion in many different directions. To me, this is one of the more interesting issues. Mm-hmm. And once again, there are different ways to measure it, but a common measure is that you see what share of the income is being taken by the top 1%.
Right? Yeah.
Especially in our time, where the 1% becomes this sort of trope almost.
Yeah, they're called one percenters
exactly,
for that reason.
Right.
Yeah,
right. So if you, and you can find these online, by the way, but if there are a lot of inequality graphs out there which measure this, right? They graph what share of the national income is being taken by the top 1%. And if you look at the graph, I would describe it basically as a bridge with two peaks. A suspension bridge.
Oh, Golden Gate Bridge.
Like the Golden Gate Bridge. And so the first peak is in the 1920s.
Yeah.
First is in the 1920s, and the second is basically today, the early 2000s.
Oh, almost 80 years apart.
Yeah,
right.
Actually, we're coming up on 100 years apart.
Wow,
yeah,
true.
Pretty much. So those are the two peaks. The top income share of the income share of the top 1% was about 24% in 1928.
Okay.
So almost a quarter of the income went to the top 1%. Then it dipped. Between 1937 and 1967, economists call this the Great Compression.
Yeah.
Coming soon to a bumper sticker near you.
Yeah.
Yes, the Great Compression, 1937 to 67. during which the top 1% received only about 10% of the national income.
Oh, okay. So we didn't come very different.
Yeah, big difference. We didn't come anywhere close to getting, you know, sort of quote unquote equality.
Right.
But the amount of inequality drastically dropped off from about a quarter to about 10%. Right. And then do the math. That means the other 99% is going from getting 76% to getting 90%.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So why is that?
We have a pretty good idea about why inequality dips during the so-called Great Compression. One, which is not related to taxation, is unionization, which is to say the percentage of jobs that are unionized in the United States peaks at about, and I laugh when I see this, laugh and cry, it peaks at about 35% in the mid-1950s. Over a third of our workforce was unionized in the 1950s.
Right.
And not surprisingly, they bargained for high wages.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
You should also know that... The ratio, and I guess I will come up on this later on as well, the ratio of CEO pay to worker pay was a much lower ratio at the time.
CEO pay, the boss's pay.
That's
the
right.
Pay.
Okay. That's something that in other words, that was also consistent with much lower levels of inequality. The other major piece, along with unionization, is marginal tax rates.
Okay, again, getting back to what we talked about. What you talked about a few minutes ago.
Right, exactly. So marginal tax rates were much more progressive.
Mm-hmm.
The rich basically paid much, much higher taxes. Now, there's some other things too, other factors we don't need to get into. For example, wages were higher due to the fact that we didn't really have any foreign competition in the 1950s.
Right.
You know,
right.
Our future competitors in the 1950s were still getting back on their feet from World
After
War II,
the war, sure.
for example,
yeah.
so clearing the rubble. You also had a much less globalized economy.
Right.
And one was much more dominated by the United States in other ways, like in terms of finance. So there are a lot of factors here. I don't want to make it seem like it's just about unions and marginal tax rates. But those are certainly two really, really big pieces of the puzzle.
And these things are happening at the same time.
Correct.
Well, let's take a break for station identification, and then we'll come back and fill out the rest of that puzzle in a minute.
This is General George Washington. I never go into battle or start a new country without consulting Professor Buzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at Professor Buzzkill. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so we're back with Professor Nash, who's explaining American taxation to not only American buzzkillers, but buzzkillers around the world. You've gotten us up to the 60s, right? Which is in living memory of many buzzkillers. What happens more recently then?
Yeah, so recently the trends and policies such as unionization or high marginal tax rates, those basically start to go away.
Yeah.
And you have other things like globalization and what they call the financialization. I love that word, the financialization of the economy. In other words, where just a much bigger percentage of overall economic activity is on paper, to put it very simply.
Right. Like, the world of finance.
Exactly. Like hedge funds, et cetera. And then you also have the tech boom, and all these things sort of conspire to skew the distribution of rewards toward the top. For example, the unionization rate today is around 10%.
Oh,
whereas
which is a third of what it was at
exactly.
Its peak.
Yeah,
okay.
Not even, right? Yeah. And so unions don't have the clout. They can't command wages. Globalization of labor also means you have extreme downward pressure on wages.
Right.
You also have more and more automation. So the workers you do keep, you can't afford to pay them as much, et cetera, et cetera. So all these other things going on. You also have a huge growth in capital gains and in CEO compensation, which I mentioned a minute ago.
Yeah, this is astounding to me because we think, at least I think, of people like my grandfather and Rockefeller and people like that as being just enormously wealthy, but they're nothing compared to
Not if you express it as this ratio. And here's my little factoid. If you express a ratio, if you have a ratio of CEO pay to worker pay, in 1965, it was on average a multiple of 20.
20 times higher?
Right. So your average CEO made 20 times what his average worker did.
Okay.
In 2018, you can find different figures, but the one I found that seemed to be the most widely cited
accepted,
is over 270 times.
270 times.
Right. And that is,
as
by the way,
to 20 times.
And that's not the recent high. It was higher a few years ago. Oh, it's actually come down a bit. So over 270 times.
Wow.
And so also, when it comes to marginal tax rates gradually declined starting in the 1960s. 70%, then 50%, and then below 30% in the late 80s. So actually in the 90s, they go back up. Under Clinton, Clinton is, I think, when we get the top marginal rate of 39.6%. But basically it was 70. And if you look at you can find this graph online as well. It will stay steady for a few years and then it'll drop again. Then it'll stay steady. So it'll plateau.
Yeah,
but still, it's basically 70, then 50, then below 30. So it comes down a lot.
So what might that then have meant to, for instance, a super rich person?
Okay, so once again.
Your Rockefellers, your Buzzkillers.
Sure, your Buzzkillers.
Yeah. Well, then we're talking about my
we'll see how Sir Buzzkiller is doing when it comes
and
to
my father's generation here.
Right. So, yeah, and once again, you could pick any 2 years, any two brackets, any two incomes, and come up with different results. So here's the caveat. At some level, this is arbitrary, but let's just say we have a super rich person in the early 1960s, because between 1962 and 1964, the top rate dropped from 91%, which it had been through the 50s, to 77%.
Right.
So just to give you some idea of what that would mean for a super rich person to go from a top rate of 91 to a top rate of 77%. And once again, the brackets of those 2 years are not the same.
Yeah.
So it's not an apples to apples comparison, but I just ran the numbers. So a hypothetical super rich person earning $600,000.
Wait a minute. Now, Buzzkillers. He said hypothetical super rich person on the outline, on the actual script, Professor Nash.
Wow, really, dude?
Hypothetical fat cat earning $60,000. You softened your analysis.
You're gonna use the power of your show to call me out while we're recording. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Well, you once said that somebody dimed out somebody else on a previous show about crime.
And somebody got iced. Not too long ago.
Iced. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you're a hypothetical fat cat earning $600,000 in 1962. So that's about $5 million today.
Okay.
So that would put them in an extreme. And that's not even 1%. I think that's like a fraction of a percent. How many people make that much money? So it's a small number of Americans. So about $5 million today per year in today's money.
Mm-hmm.
That person making $600,000 between 62 and 64, they would have seen their tax bill because of the change in the top marginal rate. Would have seen their tax bill drop from about $508,000 to in today's money. No, I'm sorry, in their money, from $508,000 to $435,000.
Wow.
Or, so for their so-called effective tax rate, in other words, not the top marginal rate, but what they pay, in this case, effective tax rate, from 84% to 72.5%.
Wow. So now, by the way, that effective tax rate is the number we should be using in contemporary discourse, but
and
people
not the top marginal rate.
Right.
And if we're naming names, if people like Steve Scalise and Scott Walker, who in public say they're going to take away 70% of your income, they're not stupid people. They should know better.
Yeah.
They should start using a term.
Well,
like
we don't know
tax
that
rate.
Not stupid people.
Here they are going to give people.
We are busting myth and taking names,
giving people the benefit of the doubt. So their effective tax rate goes from 84 to 72.5. Now you could still say, "Wow, they're taking away 72.5% of their income," but still that means they would keep an additional because of that change would keep an additional $73,000, which today is $600,000.
1960s money. Yeah. Okay.
So that change in that top marginal rate would get them an additional $600,000 in their pocket
today. Wow.
Right, in today's money, if they were making $5 million. So it's a big, big difference.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. In like I said, in that particular comparison. Now, today's federal income tax is 7 brackets, not 30.
Yeah. It's a big difference.
And I've seen this supported under the guise of simplifying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, look at all these brackets. It's so complicated. Actually,
it's 7.
But also, it's not complicated to have 30 tax brackets. It just isn't. We have things like tax accountants and TurboTax and things like that, which it's simple math. You can do it with a calculator. There are other complications to our tax code.
Right.
Many of them.
Deductions and stuff. Yeah.
Right. But brackets or the existence of multiple brackets is not one of them. Anyway.
And now we only have 7.
Exactly. Now it is simple. We have 7 brackets. They range from 10% to 37%. So the top, as I may have mentioned earlier, the top bracket is now 37. The top bracket kicks in at $600,000 for those who are married filing jointly. And I want to keep in mind there are also the different categories, which also complicates the comparisons, right? Are you an individual? Are you a household, right? Are you a married filing jointly, et cetera?
But again, the top rate doesn't kick in until you're
right. So only above $600,000 are people paying the 37%.
Okay, so what do we think is what should be the last word on the history of taxation how it's affected inequality and inequality in U.S. history?
What is my oracular bottom line here?
Well,
historically, there is no correlation between low marginal rates and high economic growth or vice versa. Because when taxes are discussed, this is often the context. Like that if you do XYZ with the tax code, you're going to do XYZ to the economy.
Yeah.
History tells us at least that there is no correlation. No. So for example, in the 1950s, you had a top marginal rate of 91%.
Right.
But you also had very healthy economic growth for most of that
post-war
decade.
Boom.
Right. That's part of the post-war boom. Right. And you've had you've had other eras where you had a relatively low top marginal rate.
Right.
And not very good economic growth or even a recession.
Okay.
So the other thing I'd say about the 1950s is if you look at the 1950s socially and culturally and economically, there was certainly no shortage of what I would call corporate ambition.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
People didn't stop trying to earn money.
No, absolutely.
Just because you had a top marginal rate, right? They were still sufficiently incentivized to try to become CEOs, to try and have a nicer house, a nicer car, earn more money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. Okay.
Anyway, that's what I would say.
Oh, well, and there you have it, Buzzkillers. Not only have we explained the history of U.S. taxation and marginal tax rates and things like that, we've explained how it all works for equality and inequality.
We've done it all.
So thank you very much, Professor Nash and Buzzkillers. We will talk to you next week.